Okay, good. Good morning. I call to order the Joint Development and Real Estate Committee. It is now 9:15 on September the 30th, 2010. You have the agenda before you. Are there additions or modifications or corrections to the agenda? Any changes to the agenda? Hearing none. Then all in favor of the agenda say aye. Aye. Opposed, no. The agenda is adopted. We have the minutes before us. I move approval of the minutes as if read. Is there a second?
Second.
It's been moved and seconded. Is there any changes, any modifications, corrections? All right. All those in favor of approving the minutes as if read, say aye. Aye. Opposed, no. The ayes have it. The minutes are approved. So we have two action items, sale of excess metro property to Montgomery County, Maryland. Mr. Bodekheimer is right here. Are you leading this discussion, sir?
I'm going to ask Mr. Golden to lead the discussion.
Mr. Chair, do we need a presentation, or may I move this item?
You're a member of the committee. You're free to make any motion you please.
I move this approval of this item.
Has been moved. Is there a second?
Second.
Is there a second? It's been moved and seconded. Is there a discussion? Discussion.
Question.
Ms. Hutchins.
I looked at the two items, and one is going to capital budget, and the other is going to skip on. Is there, what are the distinctions between the two and one?
The distinction is that this was the land that was identified as excess property. There were no transit facilities on it that needed to be replaced. So the Kissimmee Ride facilities are being replaced by the parking garage that is the reimbursable project of Montgomery County, and the land that was left excess after the construction of the garage didn't have any joint development aspects to it. So it was excess property.
And the other is
a joint development property. It's over a station entrance, and so it's a continuity of transit operations issue, and that makes it joint development.
Okay.
Further discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor say aye. Aye.
Aye.
Ayes no. The ayes have it. And that action item is approved. The second is the Navy Yard East Sale Agreement Amendment. Mr. Bodekheimer.
Again, Mr. Golden will make that presentation.
The request here is to extend the closing date for this property by 1 year, from this December to next. This will allow the sole bidder time to respond to current market conditions. The property is located at 1111 New Jersey Avenue. And again, the action that we're recommending is to amend the Navy Yard East Sale Development Agreement to extend the closing date by 1 year.
Is there a discussion? Is there a motion to approve?
Move to approve.
It's been moved by Mr. Benjamin. Is there a second?
Second.
Second by Mr. Acosta. Is there discussion? Discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor say aye. Aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. The ayes have it. That action item is approved. We now move to our information items. I had asked for a description of the current policies relating to unsolicited joint development proposals and how the authority procedurally responded and substantively responded when we received an unsolicited joint development proposal. And so we're to have our briefing today. Is Mr. Golden leading this briefing?
I'm going to lead this discussion.
Oh, you've done. Okay, we'll switch it.
We were both so eager to do it.
Yes, okay, good. All right, Mr. Bodekheimer, please.
Okay, so we sent out a memo a couple of months ago, which is summarized in the PowerPoint presentation. I think I'd rather than just walk through the presentation as it's been put together, I'll try and go through four elements of it as quickly as possible to get to the Q&A. I think that would probably be more to your liking. We divided this up into four situations. The first two that we identified were basically situations where if we had received an unsolicited proposal for a previously advertised property, it was within our discretion to accept the proposal and include it in the mix. The third situation we contemplated was a situation where we had advertised a property, we had entered into exclusive negotiations with a development partner, and at that time we would clearly reject it. The fourth situation contemplated receipt of an unsolicited proposal at a time when the negotiations with a previously selected partner had failed. And I think that's the situation that is of greatest interest. Of course, as I think you know, when we get to the end of an established time frame for negotiations, the board has a couple of options. They can reestablish a selected developer and extend negotiations, or they can, you know, if the project essentially dies, then the project can be re-advertised. In the event that we receive an unsolicited proposal for a site that's previously been advertised, and, you know, for which there are no more active proposals in consideration, basically Section 14 of the Joint Development Guidelines establishes the procedures that we can follow. And we can screen it for operational need, we screen it for jurisdictional interest, we have the authority to reject or request board approval to advertise and re-advertise the site. That's the high-level summary. Before going to the question and answer, I guess maybe the best way to make it concrete is to illustrate with two sites that have received unsolicited proposals in the last year. The first is New Calton. In the spring, we received arguably an unsolicited proposal with a statement of qualifications from an interested developer. In the event, what happened was we rejected that proposal and we came back to the board and we requested authority to issue a competitive selection process that was a request for qualifications-based approach. That was approved in July. We have a subsequent information item on that today. We also received in July an unsolicited proposal for Florida Avenue. That's a process that had gone through a joint development process. We looked again at the land and basically determined that it's not, Ms. Hutchins, you asked earlier, what was the distinction between a joint development project and an excess property, that Florida Avenue is really an excess property. Even though it had been treated as a joint development project prior, it had begun its life as an excess property. It doesn't have any transit function right now. It was acquired during the construction of the system. And so we chose to advertise it competitively using the procedures that we use for our excess property guidelines. So that's those illustrate ways that we've handled that recently. That concludes my presentation. I'd be happy to answer questions at this point.
Thank you very much for this briefing. I appreciate it, and I'm sure others do as well. I seem to recall that the policy, the Joint Development Guidelines, provided that when an unsolicited proposal was received on a joint development project that previously had been advertised but not awarded, and for whatever reason was not successfully concluded, that our guidelines provide that the proposal is then, notice is given to the public for a 30-day period that we have received an unsolicited proposal, and that the public are entitled during that 30 days to comment. And others, of course, are entitled to submit their own unsolicited proposals, and the 30-day period can be extended. Is my recollection not accurate?
Okay.
Mr. Graham, we treated the Florida Avenue process, which the board, as I recall, in March or April, tabled the matter. So we considered that process closed.
Right.
The bids that had been made were at that point, I believe, 2 to 3 years old. And we took the approach that the best thing to do was to allow...
Well, I'm not really speaking, excuse me, Mr. Golden, but I'm not really speaking about any specific project.
I understand that.
I'm just interested in knowing what the provisions are, and perhaps our legal staff. This is a legal issue. It's more than anything else. Do we, where is that?
We are consulting the 2005 guidelines that governed the the original solicitation of Florida Avenue, but it's the 2008 guidelines that would govern any current any solicitation that was issued after 2008. So that provision would have to be in the 2008 guidelines to handle it, and that is not as written.
If I could just respond to Mr. Graham's questions, I'm looking at the 2005 joint development policies and guidelines,
to Section 7.4, unsolicited proposals. And again, this is in joint development as opposed to excess property. Proposals received for development of a site which were not in response to a specific marketing effort, i.e. unsolicited proposals, will be processed as follows. One, notice of receipt of the unsolicited proposal will be published in the print media along with a modest procedure for processing unsolicited proposals.
You may want to speak closer to the mic or louder,
okay.
One or the other.
Notice of receipt of the unsolicited proposal will be published in the print media along with a modest procedure for processing unsolicited proposals. Two, WMATA will begin processing the unsolicited proposal in accordance with Section 7.3 to determine if the proposal merits selection for award of a contract. Three, if WMATA receives additional proposals before developer selection is completed on the initial unsolicited proposal, any new proposals, including the unsolicited proposal, will be competed and processed in accordance with Section 7.2. When a developer is selected for award of a contract for the site, under either 7.4.2 or 7.4.3 above, no further proposals will be entertained for that site.
Has that policy been changed since it was established?
Yes.
This was overridden by the 2008 Joint Development Guidelines. The concern that was...
So that is no longer in effect.
That's correct. This is superseded.
Okay, so it's superseded. So that the current policy is different than this one.
Yes.
Okay.
That was
the essential question, is what happened to the earlier proposal.
Yeah, and the motivation basically was that was interpreted to be too prescriptive, that by having a mechanical response to unsolicited proposals, we were basically put in a position of advertising properties that we might have concerns about, you know, their market readiness or the transit, our ability to, our understanding of the transit needs of that property. And so this rewrite of the guidelines gave staff more discretion to determine whether or not the property was ready.
Now, in the case, I just have one other question, and then we can hear your question, Mr. Wynn, or your comment. We also apparently have the ability to change what was once a joint development project into an excess property project.
Can you repeat the question just so I make sure I understand it?
Judging from what you've said about the Florida Avenue situation, is we have what was previously a joint development proposal is now being viewed as an excess property.
That's correct.
Situation.
That's correct.
And you have the flexibility to make that change in terms of the development status of the project.
My understanding of our authority is yes, we do.
Okay. All right, Mr. Linden.
Well, I think you might have answered my question because I was trying to see if there a distinction was made in a real estate unsolicited proposal versus a non-real estate unsolicited proposal. Because I assume in the non-real estate unsolicited proposal, we basically receive the proposal, we acknowledge to the public that we received the proposal, and we therefore allow others to therefore respond. Is that generally correct?
So are you distinguishing between an unsolicited proposal to purchase or develop real estate versus to develop a...
No, I'm talking about generically. A generic unsolicited proposal, the general response to that is what?
If it's not involving real estate, I believe it would be covered by the procurement manual. And
which is?
The provisions of how it's treated, I...
Is anybody else helping with that? I'm not going to let you get away with the procurement manual.
Under our current procurement guidelines, if there is an unsolicited proposal, if it falls outside of a current solicitation, the chief procurement officer would typically deny the solicitation and would not include that in the current solicitation. So that's how their procurement guidelines work now.
Deny the solicitation?
Well, they would deny the participation of that unsolicited proposal if it did not work within the framework of the current solicitation that was out.
Okay, no, but I'm saying there is no solicitation out at all.
Right.
We get an interested party that has an idea. Mm-hmm. They present it to Metro as an unsolicited proposal with no solicitation out.
So
how do we handle it?
So typically what we would do is we would take that unsolicited proposal, we would look to staff to figure out whether or not we would determine that was the proposal that we would want to proceed with. We would send out then a statement of work and do a competitive selection and put that out into the market.
Okay.
And that's how we would treat
okay.
it.
Okay, so that's pretty much what I thought. Thank you. The discretion that you have in determining whether or not a property is a joint development versus excess property, I would assume that's based upon some condition or activity or something going on there at the site that allows you to make that change. Is that correct?
Question of whether it's a transit station area and a transit property that requires ongoing transit operations to be preserved. I mean, when we disposed of Southeast Bus Garage, for example, it's a transit facility, but it's one that we are abandoning because we were moving on to another place. We dealt with it as an excess property disposal.
So the answer, I guess, basically is yes.
Yeah.
So, you know, is that so there are specific considerations. It's not kind of arbitrary. There are specific considerations that determine moving it from a joint development to excess property, and those are generally operationally driven. Operationally and needs of the agency group.
Preservation of transit operations on the site makes it a joint development problem.
Okay.
Could you just succinctly state, and this might involve a little repetition, but just for the sake of clarity, the difference between how we deal with an unsolicited proposal in the case of a joint development, a prior joint development proposal that did not successfully conclude. What is the difference between that and an excess property situation in terms of how we proceed with an unsolicited proposal?
Well, with an excess property, what we do is we follow it's the real estate
manual.
The real estate manual it has a little bit more latitude. As you know, many of the properties that we bring you for approval that are excess properties have not received previous board approval. Often what will happen is we get an unsolicited proposal and we treat it depending on a set of criteria that are laid out there. But, you know, for example, if there's an adjacent property owner and there's nobody else it has any value to, we'll negotiate exclusively with them. If we get an unsolicited proposal and it's a property that has independent utility, we go out with a competitive process. There are also procedures to deal with, as with, again, with the Glenmont Garage, the negotiation directly with the jurisdiction. But we can advertise those properties, and we pass practice, established practices that we bring them to the board for approval after advertisement. And
So in the case of Florida Avenue, what are you doing at present?
We've advertised it as an excess property competitively. It's a best offer proposal. We've asked for proposals on the three properties there, and we've given them the opportunity to propose either a purchase or a long-term lease. We wanted to give every proposer an opportunity to propose one or the other because we realize that the board has
They can do both.
They can do both, right? Because we wanted to give the board the opportunity to make the decision between the best sale opportunity and the best lease opportunity, understanding that there's an important policy issue there, and we didn't want any developer to be artificially excluded by having been on sale and then found out that the lease was what was desired or vice versa. So what we followed in mid-August, we let you all know that we were advertising it. It was advertised September, about 5 weeks later, September 15th, and when are the bids
October 22nd.
Due? October 27th, the 2nd is when bids are due. And we would bring those proposals back. There's no negotiation with the proposers. We just bring what we think is the best offer back to the board and ask for board approval of that recommendation.
And what is the community consultation in this process as compared to the joint development process?
Well, our assumption is that the community consultation process would come through the development approvals process conducted by the city, that the subsequent owner of the property would follow all the local requirements, and there wouldn't be any it would follow local planning zoning law.
Unless this was changed, I recall the joint development guidelines having some fairly detailed requirements insofar as the developer's responsibilities relating to community consultation.
That's correct. There are very substantial requirements on the developer to do that in the joint development program. I think that that's largely because we would want to have community input into the balancing of the way private users are using our transit property and the way transit users are. So, for example, if a parking garage was moved to a very remote corner of the site, the public would justifiably have input into that consideration. Where it's an excess property and we don't have this question of where to put transit facilities on the site, we think this is a lower threshold for the public involvement.
And the board does not make the decision as to what is joint development, what is excess property. That is a staff discretion.
Well, that's, again, my understanding.
They make the decision in the sense that when we come forward and request that we be allowed to issue something as a joint development project through an RFQ like we did, they have the opportunity at that point.
Or if we bring it to the board as an excess property and the board decides that corporately that you don't want to pursue it this way. And that may well happen. We figured basically that this was a way to,
I think very broadly and simply what we do is we say, is there a train station next to it? Is it above a train station? That's clearly a joint development project. If it doesn't meet those criteria and it doesn't have the kinds of operational requirements that Matt talked about, then we go excess property. Broadly, what we're trying to do is to allow free and open markets to determine the prices of our real estate wherever we can, and clearly there's no better way to do that than through a disposition of excess property through a sealed bid process.
Mr. Chair, I'm concerned, Mr. Golden, in your statement and Mr. Bodenheimer's statement, because it doesn't match what I remember to be the criteria for what becomes a joint development project. And I'm not talking about Florida Avenue in this particular case. I'm talking about the broader issue of joint development. In the past, at least, unless something changed in these guidelines, we've considered joint development to be an eligible activity for any property that we own that's large enough to do anything with. And we've very specifically talked about things that are away from transit stations, including bus garages, and including right-of-way, and including other property that we own. So I'm a little bit concerned that you're saying if it's a transit station, then it's joint development. If it's anywhere else, it's excess property. I hope that's not what our guidelines say.
Clearly not with a bus garage. I mean, that would be a different case. That's a large site.
I think the question here is about what staff's authority is to determine what is a excess property versus what.
No, I'm not asking about this instance. I'm asking about our overall procedure. I don't believe our procedure, as I remember it, draws the line that you're currently drawing between excess property and joint development. If so, could you read that to me? Because I'd like to change it, because I think we should have. We should consider joint development to be, over a right-of-way or over a large piece of excess property that we have.
Well, the definition of joint development and the joint development guidelines is, and this is pretty much what it was in 2005 as well, I believe, a creative program through which property interests owned and or controlled by WMATA are marketed to office, retail, commercial, recreational, entertainment, and residential developers with the objective of developing transit-oriented development projects. And you are correct, it does not make that distinction there.
I would encourage staff not to make that distinction, but to have a broader definition of what could be joint development. Now, that doesn't say that we couldn't decide that something near or at a transit station was also excess property as opposed to joint development. But the line that you were drawing, I think, is one that we don't want to establish, and I don't think the record should ever show that.
I would agree with that, Mr. Benjamin, and I would also add that this is also a case where this board determined it was a joint development project, and we advertised it as such. So we've said this is a duck, and now we're being told, no, it's not really a goose. And this is more than just an academic discussion, because, as I think my questioning revealed, is the impact on community engagement is very considerable between the two. And while I too don't want to necessarily dwell on a specific project, I have a lot of people on Florida Avenue who have been through a very long process with that site as a joint development project who are now very concerned that because it's been categorized as excess property rather than joint development, that the community input is very different in terms of the requirements of our joint development guidelines. So there are real consequences to this as well. So I don't know where we are on this, but I think that I'm concerned about the extent to which the community is involved in these decisions. And saying that this will occur during the zoning or the PUD process or, you know, later on after we've awarded, you know, the site is, it doesn't really respond to what I'm looking for. At least that's the issue. That's the issue that I was aiming at bringing up.
Well, actually, I think that's a very legitimate issue, although all your issues are legitimate, so I'm not trying to qualify. But the point I'm making here is that, and I think, you know, as you've been further going through it, Mr. Graham, I'm very concerned that we have engaged community in their area to have involvement in a project. And I have no, you know, I have nothing in Florida Avenue. So this is not related to anything that I'm concerned about regarding Florida Avenue or have any interest in Florida Avenue other than as a board member. But
I think specifically if we're going to engage community and they're going to have input based upon what's going to happen to their environment and we engage them in that process and then we change and say, oh, now we've decided that you no longer need to be engaged and we're going to make this decision without your input. That goes a long way in hurting your credibility, if nothing else. And I think that kind of abrupt change in a process in of itself, we should give some strong consideration to.
Well, I think that was the point I was making. I mean, I think we've got there's real substance involved in this. And since you put out an RFP on this or an RFQ, and we've received one unsolicited proposal. I mean, maybe the thing to do is to have you come back to the committee with, insofar as any pending unsolicited proposal situations, with a process whereby we can solicit community input. So we don't have to. I don't want to. This has been pending for so many years. This particular site that I have in foremost in my mind, that I don't want to upset this apple cart in its entirety, but I would like to ensure that there is community engagement with those who are bringing in proposals.
Mr. Chair, at this point, this already is out as an RFP as excess property?
It is.
That's correct.
Is there... In this particular case, it used to be a joint development project. Is there a problem with continuing in this direction and adding community involvement as a criterion for this particular project before we act on it?
But what is the page of the guideline? Just let me ask this. What's the page of the guideline as a community engagement?
Well, this would not be in the guideline if it's excess property.
No, but just to see the model that we would be using. I mean, if I could just have what section is it?
Well, the guideline specifically is 5.5 in the joint development guidelines. There are also throughout in 5.3 local jurisdictions and 5.4 developers references to coordination with the community.
is this pre-award, post-award?
Each section is a general requirements.
Well, that is an issue. Rather than us trying to fashion, what I was trying to get at, Mr. Benjamin, is permitting them to go back and think about this. Since this was on the agenda as an information item. Mm-hmm. And the deadline for solicitation, did I hear?
October
22nd.
22nd. So we'll meet again, or we could meet again.
It would have to be a special meeting.
We could meet again to consider this.
I guess the question I have is, do we lose anything by continuing with this and adding to it if your concern is community participation, a requirement for community participation by whoever we select either before or after? Does that... I mean, I presume we will make the selection on this, right?
If we include a community participation requirement, we would have to notify the proposers of that beforehand. That might be something that would be material to the proposals. So, I mean, one alternative would simply be to extend the deadline of the RFP, which is something that can be done mid-course.
That may make more sense then.
But it also may make sense It also may make sense to simply, after the proposals are submitted, because we don't know who's going to submit proposals at this point, is that we then require those proposals to be vetted through the community process.
Well, I think what I'm hearing from staff is, if you're going to do that to somebody, you need to do it before they bid, not after they bid.
I mean, somebody's going to make a price proposal. They may have just said, I'm going to put my oar in the water, but I'm not up for, you know, this process, and they may, you know.
So I could see extending the bid long enough for this committee to conclude together with staff whether there should be a community involvement process involved.
The notice that we would need to send to make to the RFP at this point is to say we're extending the date. We've been asked to include a community consideration component to this. We'll be presenting this to the board. We will make modifications to the, you know, as directed by the board.
I would make it may or may not, because we aren't doing anything at this point.
It would be may or may not is definitely the language, and that we would ask them to stay tuned and pay attention to the RFP to see if the substance of the RFP changes. But at a minimum, immediately, the deadline of submission date is extended.
Because Mr. Graham's concern is a pretty legitimate one. It makes sense that if we were going to require it, if it were a joint development project, it would make sense to also require it for the same piece of land if it weren't. So I sort of like the idea of what you're suggesting, and that doesn't require board action because your initial action didn't require board action.
So I've gotten a sense of what you all would like. Is this procedurally, do you all need to make a motion as to
No. That's what I'm just saying is you went ahead without us to begin with. Therefore, you have the authority to continue without us now. All we're suggesting is your proposal is a good one, and it would give us some room to actually think this through, work it through, and come up with a process.
Fine. We will come back to you with a proposal for that.
Mr. Downey?
A question on that. I wouldn't want to suggest that every excess property disposition should go through this process.
Exactly.
We shouldn't go to people across the street from where the firehouse is going to be and say, what do you think of the firehouse? But maybe the question would be, what would the criteria be under which a disposition would require community input?
Yeah, Mr. Downey, that was exactly my intent, and that was the reason that I liked the idea of extending the deadline to give us time to think through those kinds of things and make very clear whether this is a one-time only issue, has to do with the size of the land, has to do with the history, whatever.
For a comment, I agree with that, but my intent was exactly that, Mr. Downey. It was specific to a situation where the community had been engaged before. And I didn't want to abruptly kind of take them out of the process because it seems to suggest that we're doing something devious. And I would prefer that we, you know, stay consistent with that. But I would not want to offer this as an ongoing process for excess property.
Further question. In the case of joint development, my understanding is that process typically involves both the authority and the developer to be talking about what is happening. Here there's nobody
in the jurisdiction
who has made a proposal, said I'm going to buy this. So I assume if you had community input, it would be entirely.
We have one.
We have a proposal, but I don't know that proposal suggests what they're going to do with the property. They're going to acquire it. And what we're really saying is, the point here is, how do we get the input from the community before the authority makes its decision? Not how does it become part of an ongoing process in which we're working with a development partner to sketch it out.
Okay. Yeah, and I'm very concerned that we don't go back to square one, because the pending unsolicited proposal was a proposal from a proponent who previously had submitted a proposal. So this is somebody who was considered, and for various reasons that some of us will remember and others maybe not remember, relating to the purchase price of this property that was offered to us, they were rejected. And so they've come back and they said, let us renew and refresh our proposal. And that's, of course, something that could be considered also under our joint development guidelines. So I want to take into account that this has been a process that's been going on for a number of years. I'm going to say 7 years in my experience. And while I want community engagement, I don't want to go to square one. I don't want this to be delayed for a very lengthy period of time. I want to make sure the community, which is poised and has already been involved, can be just re-included in the process, and we can move forward with whatever we decide to do. But I think we need to have that engagement. Okay?
Okay.
So I think you have a guidance without us taking any action. Is there further discussion on this matter? Okay. And we have a second information item, which is somewhat similar in the sense that I thought it was important for the board, and the general manager thought it was important to distribute to you a letter on the issue of pre-development costs. This relates specifically to a project in Maryland, but it has far-reaching implications in terms of how we treat pre-development costs. Is there a presentation on this, gentlemen?
Yes.
Is Mr. Golden making
yes.
it?
The Joint Development Program, as you all know, has a long history here at Metro. We've had many successes in urban core and established markets. But in our markets where we have large open sites, we've found that there are problems with designing those sites and developing them in a timely fashion. In the old process, it was controlled by the developer. Metro's role was one of review only. We want to move to an open collaborative design process. We want to reduce the overall time to get these projects out of the ground. Previously, transit and TOD needs were not well addressed. We've got very complex design issues on these sites in terms of bus locations, kiss and rides, taxi stands, and so forth. The expenses were incurred over many years under the old system. Developers would discount their purchase offers to reflect the uncertainties of what the actual development footprint was. And what we want to do is have an open accounting of costs. We want to improve the returns to Metro. We want to make sure that we get as much as we can for these sites from the development community. New Carrollton has very complex design issues. We've obviously got the Purple Line platforms. We've got the bus bays I mentioned, the amount and relocation of commuter parking, some of the other facilities I mentioned, bike, pedestrian, ADA. There are public elements envisioned in the New Carrollton sector plan. And then we've got just the typical real estate issues of where pads go, entrances, service lanes, and so forth. It's a very intensive, time-consuming, collaborative effort. And in the past, what's happened is we've done an RFP. The development community looks at the site and says, wow, here's 40 acres. Well, I don't really know how to value it. I don't even know how big the footprint is because I don't know where all these Metro-required improvements have to go. And so what happened was many of the better quality developers would not respond, or a developer would respond with a reduced price to reflect all that uncertainty. And then we had this very difficult, time-consuming, multi-year process where the developer tried to get sequential consensus from the different Metro silos, bus, parking, et cetera. Then had to go sort of do the same thing with the jurisdictional staff. What we want to do is bring everyone to the table simultaneously. And again, this does not apply to our urban and our core sites. Those are tightly defined with no uncertainties. This is for those large sites. New Carrollton is a great example in Prince George's County. Bring the developer to the table. Bring the developer or the development team that we select through an RFQ process. The very best firms with a track record and deep financial resources, bring them to the table with all of the silos within Metro, all of the jurisdictional staff, and design this thing together over 12 months in a collaborative way with creative and constructive dissension, but to come up with a project that works for everybody and is going to yield the highest value for Metro, increase our ridership, and improve accessibility. And the approach is one that everyone is excited about. All the staff at Metro and the jurisdictions, the development community are excited about this approach because they've all been through the old approach, which does not work. The challenge is, how do you pay for it? Normally, a land seller would deliver to a potential buyer a site where what can be developed on the site is defined. Here's the zoning. The buyer looks at the site and says, okay, I know what I can build. Here's the land residual. But we've got these special issues that I talked about because we're a transit operation. I mentioned that before. And so what we're saying is, this is going to cost about $1 million for professionals, including engaging the public in this process. And we don't have that money. And so we're doing two things. We're proposing two things. One is MDOT is making available $350,000 of consultant services from their on-call list. And we're proposing that the developer advance $650,000 that we would have spent anyway. That's the key point. We would have spent this money anyway. We simply don't have it. And in exchange for him doing that, we're going to credit him that those funds when he takes down the first phase of land. What the approach does is it gets us where we wanted to go but couldn't afford to go, and it gets us there faster, and in the end we get a better project that achieves the goals I talked about. And that is the basic rationale behind this. We expect to get a multiple return of that $650,000 because when you sell something that is fully defined, you're going to get a higher price. So we're not only going to get the $650 back, but we're going to get a multiple of that. The intent was to do more with less. We're trying to work with, you know, limited financial resources and limited staff. We are very much behind the effort to bring transit-oriented development out to Prince George's County, where the elected officials and the community want transit-oriented development. And in light of our limited resources and the challenges we've had with these kinds of large sites in the past, this seemed like a creative solution at no cost to Metro to proceed. We intend to come to the board on December 16th with a developer recommendation. Our intent was at that time to ask your approval for this process. And we specifically said in the RFP, there's a very clear disclaimer that this approach is subject to board approval. It's something we'll emphasize again at the mandatory pre-conference next Tuesday. And if the board prefers, we can come to the board prior to the December meeting specifically for approval of that item.
Okay, first, yes?
Yeah, I just wanted to add to that again. One of the concerns that we've heard about this approach is, you know, whether this is an innovation, whether this is consistent with board policy. And again, this is really something that I think was contemplated by the Joint Development Guidelines. And in Section 5, the General Manager's responsibilities, Section 5.2, items 5, 7, and 8 all contemplate this kind of thing: minimization of time to reach agreement, collaboration with developers to obtain zoning and development approvals, use of mechanisms that maximize developer interest. And then again, in Section 6.1, joint development objectives, there are a similar set of objectives, concluding with item 6, use all available approaches to maximize development industry interest. And that's, I mean, really, this was not a prescriptive section saying this is the defined basket of tools you can use, but it was more open-ended, saying we recognize that there are places where there are challenges, and you should, subject to board approval, of course, explore all available tools that are available to you to maximize developer interest, improve TOD outcomes. And so that's what we're trying to do here.
Thank you. Just a couple of basic questions. First, what the current policy, or let's say the current approach insofar as pre-development costs at this agency, is what is to be found generally everywhere, which is that if people figure out, you know, how pre-development costs are a factor in what their offer is for a particular parcel of land, and all of that is brought to bear, and you come up with an amount of money and you make the offer and so forth. The difference here, and that's what we've been previously doing, right, in terms of our joint development?
Well, I don't know exactly what our development partners have been doing, but I assume that they're...
Right, but I mean, but what the RFP, RFQ in this case, indicated, which was not before this board, which is a concern to me, is that the pre-development costs with a cap of $650,000 would be deducted from the negotiated land value of, in the deal. And so we're giving that assurance up front, and we're saying that to the tune of a maximum of $650,000, we will commit to taking that off the top in terms of the value of the land. This is a substantive change in the way we've been doing this. as compared to joint development proposals in the past. To my knowledge, correct me if I'm wrong.
No, we have never made this type of commitment.
And I'm not saying we have made it here, because you've emphasized that after the process is nearly completed, you're going to come back to us and then have us approve it, which is very nearly, you know, too late. I mean, a lot's going to be at stake at that point.
Well, I think
let me just finish. I thought it was important with this kind of change that this board be given the opportunity to review it, because this can't just be for New Carlton. This has got to be, you know, New Carlton is not the first complicated joint development proposal or project that we've done. I mean, there have been others, obviously, many others, that have been every bit as complicated, if not more complicated, than this one. And we have not made such a commitment in terms of pre-development costs coming off the negotiated value of the land. So I wanted to have this discussion. This is on the agenda as an information item. So that this committee and the board would be aware of what was being proposed here. I want to commend the general manager, because to his credit, he did put out a memorandum on this to alert us, and all of us received that memorandum. So this is not the first we're hearing of it. But when I saw the memorandum and I recollected what we had approved, I didn't remember this being part of it, and in fact, it wasn't part of it. So this is a change in approach, which is significant. I have spoken in the last 24 hours to several developers who have done joint development projects at Metro WMATA, and they agree with me that this is a significant change. This is not just about transparency and technicalities. This type of commitment really does encourage a forward movement, and it's very different than what they had to deal with. So I think this is a useful discussion for us to have as an information item at this point, to understand just what is being done. Did you have further you wish to say, Mr. Bordenkamp?
Not at this moment.
Okay. So that's the point of this discussion. Mr. Giancole?
Yes, I'd like to go back to page, 36, which lists what we hope to accomplish in the project. Go through a series of bullets, and I guess the question I had is that, do we have any existing backlog of infrastructure items in the bus and rail side at that station that we need to maybe consider incorporating in this project?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there are existing.
But it's not clear from the brief sheet that you're doing that. That's why I'm.
I'm sorry. You're saying it's not clear from.
No. I just wanted to make sure you are including those kinds of things in there.
Oh, absolutely. Yes.
Okay. All right, and there's an Amtrak station there, correct?
That's correct.
Are they involved at all in this process?
Yes. I met with my counterpart at Amtrak about a month and a half ago. We talked about a broad range of issues beyond New Carrollton, and one of the great things was strengthening of a direct relationship between the two real estate departments now, which has had some benefits on other issues we deal with on Amtrak.
Are they anticipating any improvements that they'd want to incorporate?
Yeah, but at this point, this is simply a request for qualifications to pick a team. The next step, once we have someone, is to engage all those parties, including Amtrak, to be at the table and get into the kinds of details you're talking about.
Thank you.
Thank you. Further discussion, Ms. Hutchins?
It sounds like a very good process, and I think the clarity I'd like to have is that through some analysis you've reached and the board will have reached that this is good for this type of development because of the difficulty of trying to arrive at what would happen and what would make it best. And I think sometimes, and just to clarify, either that it's going to come to us as an individual using the as an individual application using the guidelines, because I think in arriving at this decision, hopefully we've weighed what costs we've already spent in this. That is, given this property, if you have a property that you've gone up the flag and down the flag and you never get to the solution that you want, or you get the right developer that you want, there's a better opportunity to find folks that can come to the table and do this. So my only concern is that we all evaluate when it's the most appropriate time to use the table.
And then we do that before we put out the RFQ.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, that's similar questions I had along those lines is, one, how did we determine the cash amount? I mean, how did we decide that we were looking at a necessary expenditure of roughly $1 million for consultant services and planning?
Based on my experience developing COD sites in New Jersey, we would budget $2.5 million per site, and we'd spend $2.5 million. Obviously, that's probably too big a number here, and so we're going to do it.
But that's based on acreage?
No, it's well, part of it is acreage. I mean, the sites I'm talking about from personal experience were 44 and 25 acres, respectively. This is 39. Those were each $2.5 million. And, you know, one of the things I bring to the table is having, through experience, learned how to do those tasks for less money. You know, probably wasted some money back when I did those, and I think we can do it for $1 million.
And also, I would just add to that as well that from experience with transit-oriented development projects of similar scope in Baltimore City when I was at Maryland DOT, that was approximately the level of funding that you would put out there as well in that order of magnitude.
Okay, The $350,000 that's put up, suppose you begin an evaluation and the developer decides they don't want to move forward. What happens to the $350,000? Is that $350,000 that the jurisdiction is out, or are we also looking at it? One, are they out that? And then two, depending on where we are in terms of the analysis, is that information then proprietary to WMATA for future use?
Yeah, it's very clear that we keep the work product. It belongs to us. And that, obviously, if it stops at, say, the 40% point, we'll have spent 40% of the dollars, to keep it simple. We keep that 40% of work product. We bring in the next developer. He picks up where the other fellow left off. And the first guy doesn't get reimbursed until the second developer takes down the land. So we're never out more than the $650,000 to reimburse, again, for monies we would have spent anyway.
Your question was whether Maryland DOT is contributing their funds.
Same thing.
Simply to.
They would contribute the funds. Let's say $100,000 had been expended, you'd have $100,000 of work product to continue on with the second developer.
They're not contemplating being reimbursed.
So whatever they invest is an investment in WMATA, regardless of whether the actual joint development or proposal moves forward.
And also in the value of MDOT's land, because MDOT has, because this is a proposal, the RFQ that was approved and the MOU that was approved was for the joint solicitation of our property and of a parking lot that MDOT owns across the street, as well as in play is the road that is between the parking lot and our site, because it is actually owned by the state. So.
Okay, so whatever money is expended and whatever product you have for that money is something that is available to the investor, in this case MDOT and WMATA, for future use and information for future development proposals should this one not move forward.
Absolutely. And if we get through a stage of development review in the county, for example, and we get a concept site plan approved, I mean, the concept site plan approval belongs to the owner of the land, and so that will be value that we have and that we will be trying to achieve. I mean, that's exactly the kind of thing that we would like to have as a basis of negotiating a future price, because if we have that site plan approval, that is a level of certainty that has a tremendous real estate value. So that's a very practical reason for us to want to have in our shredding process the development review team from the county side as well. So, you know, they're saying, okay, that, you know, where you've located Kiss and Ride, that's terrific, and the pedestrian pathways are fine, and this plaza works for our, you know, our open space requirements. So, you know, okay, we're going to give it site plan approval, and from a developer point of view, to be able to have that in hand, I mean, I think everyone around the table recognizes that that's value.
Okay, and my last question is, there's been several mentions during this that because of the financial constraints at WMATA at this time, we're looking at that. I heard that several times. And so are we going to see criteria under which we look at this in the future? I mean, I think it's been made clear that we'd like to know this up front, the beginning of the process in the future, but is this something that scales up and down depending on complexity, and a system that the staff is advocating we endorse and get involved in during this period of time for all such projects, or is this a case-by-case, and in the future we're going to know at the beginning of the process that we're using this tool for this proposal?
Yes. When we come with a request for an RFQ, again, this is only for large sites, and those sites for the same reason would be RFQs, not RFPs, we would say, in this case, we would like to use this process. Here's our budget estimate for this site. Same approach, same methodology, case by case.
Okay. Thank
you. Just quickly, why didn't you do it in this case? Why didn't you bring this forward when the board...
Because my thinking was that because there was no cost to Metro, that there was no need to get board approval. And if that was an incorrect assumption, I take responsibility for that.
Mr. Downey?
Yeah.
Mr. Benjamin?
Following up on that, and then one other question. When you say no cost to Metro, you're saying the developer will be paying the cost of this consultant.
Correct.
Metro is not cash out of pocket.
That's correct.
And as I understand, the comparison to the past is developers have always incurred these costs and factored that into what they ultimately
That is correct, and I guess I would also...
This is making explicit what was always implicit in the...
Correct, and I also think that there's, I mean, there have been a lot of costs incurred on Metro's side that have never really been fully accounted for. And when you have these development, joint development projects that have persisted 6, 7, 8 years, there's an enormous amount of internal staff time that goes into the repeated reviewing of developer plans. And these are really, those costs are things that have evaporated and are not explicit. In addition, as we've said, we're talking about a credit against the land value as if we're going to be losing money. But, if as a result of this process, we get a $20 million proposal instead of a $10 million proposal, we're crediting, giving a credit against a much larger value than we would have gotten in the previous approach.
That is the essential point. Yeah. That is the essential
and
point.
Following up on that, in these long processes, who will be speaking with one voice for Metro?
I've been
involved in similar kinds of efforts, and one of the concerns always is getting whipsawed between departments, between interests. So how those get resolved is as important to the outcome as...
That was very much a concern of the Joint Development Task Force that met for a little over a year, a couple of years ago. It was their work that informed the update of the Joint Development Guidelines. They are extremely concerned about... different departments of Metro having different views of how to solve problems, and our intent is to raise those issues when they arise much more quickly, much more explicitly.
If there's an open process to do it, but somebody has to resolve them.
And to the extent that they're
not developers.
I'm sorry, and that's the general manager, and he recognized that immediately. and also to the extent that there are issues that come up that are board policy issues, those we'll bring back as well. In some future joint development projects, we may have questions about whether the right way to replace parking on site is full replacement, adding new parking spaces, reducing some parking spaces. And that kind of decision, I think, we would want to bring to the board well before we negotiated a value with the developer, because the value of the term sheet would depend enormously on, and the use of funds that are generated by the project, on the total value, and that's an important issue.
That would be brought in the context of an optimized solution.
Absolutely.
So here's what we're getting. Here's why this is important to it.
Yes.
Ms. Shula?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. First of all, thank you, Mr. Bodenheimer, and also Mr. Golden for your presentation today, because clearly there were a lot of questions, and you provided a lot of clarification. I also want to thank Mr. Sarles, too, for your memo as well. We in Prince George's County, and also in conjunction with MDOT, are very, very, very encouraged about this. As you stated, Mr. Golden, we are in dire straits for transit-oriented development in the county at our 15 metro stations. And while Mr. Graham has indicated this has never been done before, and it really hasn't, it's going in a different direction, but I do like your quote where you said this was encourages forward movement, and I think that's exactly what this is. It's a forward movement, and it may not be applicable everywhere. I think that was the crux of Mr. McKay's question, that is this going to be uniform, or is it going to be pursued on a case-by-case basis? And I think there are a number of factors that come together to determine, whether this would, whether this would be warranted or not. I think New Carrollton is the classic example where it is warranted for all the reasons stated herein. And considering, it's such a hub there with Amtrak there, and, you have the MDOT property there, too. So I think that's, it makes sense. And what was not clear apparently to everyone was that there's no loss of money to WMATA at all, and as a matter of fact, it's the contrary, because it's likely to yield a higher return, so a multiple return, higher price. So I guess what it sounds like to me is that the only issue here was that there wasn't the advanced knowledge that we were going in this different direction, and Yvonne, that I'm
asking forgiveness, having not asked permission.
I don't have a problem with it, but we do. But information is important, and now we know. Now we know. So if warranted in any other situation, it would be discussed, and maybe it works and maybe it doesn't. But I think it's definitely appropriate in this situation for New Carrollton, and I do thank you for enlightening us with all the myriad reasons why it makes sense.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Benjamin.
I just want to make sure that I heard all the right things as we were talking here. Because an awful lot of things get said, and I don't know how many of them I heard right or didn't hear right. First of all, I heard that there is no specific authorization in our guidelines to allow you to do this. There's nothing that prevents you from doing this, but you are encouraged to be innovative. Is that right?
Yes.
And that when you went ahead and did this, you did it only subject to board approval.
Yes. Yes.
And will that board approval be sought before or after the $650,000 is spent by the developer?
Before.
So the developer will not be at risk in terms of going ahead and then saying, but we thought you were going to do this.
No,
board,
no risk.
The board will have approved it before we go there. Okay, so we will get our shot at it before anybody incurs any cost on this.
The developer wouldn't expend any funds before a selection of a developer, which we would bring back to you in December.
Okay.
As so, expected.
The next thing I thought I heard is this is money that we probably would have spent anyway.
And correct.
Is that staff time that you're referring to?
Correct.
Okay. So one way or another, you think we would have spent this, and in this case, we effectively are reducing the price an equivalent amount.
Correct.
And the last thing I thought I heard was this actually makes us money rather than losing us money because of the timing of when we get the bid. In other words, if I understand what you said, is at the beginning, if we were doing this and a developer were required to do this in the process, they would want to know they were the developer before they'd start spending $1 million. And so they wouldn't do it before they'd won the bid.
Yes.
So they would have made a bid based upon the unknown of all the planning and plotting and everything else that's got to go on, planning and all the other things that have got to go on.
Correct.
Okay. So they would therefore have bid, and I'm listening to Mr. Golden's multiple times, quote about the $650,000. They would have bid substantially lower to discount for what might have happened.
That's what developers do, yeah.
In this case, though, you're not actually going for a bid from this developer, are you? You're going to a negotiated price based upon appraisals?
First selection is based on their qualifications. Mm-hmm. At that point, if the selection is made, and they've
once the design is done, say a year from now, then we'll do appraisals of the first phase.
And but that's after this money's been spent or before?
That's after the money's been spent, because you have to design the project.
And you believe that those appraisals will be many times larger than they would than a bid would have been without all this work having been
done. Because at that point, the developer knows exactly what his development plan is going to be, as opposed to our current process, where he has no idea because he doesn't know where all those components have to go. He doesn't know what his development footprint is.
So if I interpret that correctly, by our investing $650,000, or essentially reducing the eventual amount that we get by $650,000, will actually make more than that in terms of the value of the land when we do our eventual
yes.
lease or sale?
Multiples. Of
yes.
That.
And you feel very sure about that?
Yes.
That's why we're doing this.
Okay. I think I heard all the pieces.
All right, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Linton, Mr. McKay.
Sorry, I stepped out of the room at the time, but there, you know, from what I heard, when we, and Mr. Downey may remember this, but when we rolled out the joint development and TOD guidelines at FTA under our administration, we had a number of listening sessions around the country. One of those actually was held at the National Building Museum here, jointly with WMATA. And at the time, we solicited input from developers about the projects around the country, their concerns, and things that they found difficult that prevented them from wanting to engage in development with the transit agencies. One of the things we heard was the significant uncertainty on their part about all of the transit-specific changes and challenges and unknowns that in the midst of a development, this would prop up because there was a transit need for access, and how that kind of scared them away. Of course, in most projects, they kind of know going in, this is what I got, this is what I'm working with. It's not this other party that's subject to all these government rules and policies and the like. So I think this approach, one, lays out clearly, it protects our interests so that we clearly define what it is that metro-specific needs. The developer knows that going in, so that also creates more interest from their point. So that solves one of those problems. The other thing is making sure that from our standpoint, the project is consistent with what we want to do as an agency. And we established that from the very beginning. Even though we're into joint development, we're still a transit agency. We still have operational requirements. We still have a future here. And when we can be at the very beginning of a project, beginning to scope it out, working with the developers, defining all those elements at the very beginning, that upfront investment pays off not just in the money that we get in the back end, but also the better project and the long-term viability we have for our clients and our customers. So I think it's a great investment, and it's a good way to go. It's different than what we've done in the past. It's a little more creative. But, you know, change and creativity is not bad, particularly if it gives you a better result. I think, you know, it's something that we should go forth with, and it sounds like a great approach.
Mr. McKay?
Thank you. And I just wanted to continue along Mr. Benjamin's line of thought and make sure I understand I'm drawing the right conclusions. If more than $1 million is necessary for design support, any dollar over that will be solely the responsibility of the developer partner.
Yes.
That's correct?
Yes.
Okay. And secondly, at the end of the process, at whatever junction that it happens to end, hopefully in a successful project, but something short of that, we have a product that we own so that when the next time we look at this property for a proposal or development activity, we're not starting from scratch again because, you know, these planning and design activities can be exhaustive, both for our staff but also for the community. And if we've made a lot of headway and drawn a lot of conclusions about what we want to see happen on that property, we're not going to be starting completely over again when looking at this property in the future if the original proposal doesn't actually get built.
That's correct.
Okay. Thank you.
I didn't hear him say the one thing that I think is important. Will the community be involved in this process at all?
Yes,
absolutely.
Okay, because that's a really good key piece.
Starting with the viewing of the request for qualifications and the developer proposals.
Very good.
Mr. Acosta.
Yeah, first of all, I'd like to thank you for bringing this proposal to our attention. It is creative, it is innovative, and I encourage that sort of thinking of this authority. I think the question is really, you know, you have a new idea. How do you measure success? How do you define success? And I think there were a number of questions about whether we could replicate this approach at other, you know, similar properties or locations throughout the authority. So my question is, how do you evaluate this? And as you're kind of going through this, this is really a pilot. How would you go about evaluating this so we could take, you know, so we can assess whether this is something we want to do again, and then whether your assumptions, you know, given the old and the new approach, are actually valid.
One is going to be speed. One is going to be the community and local jurisdiction support. I mean, there's so many things that have to line up for one of these projects to go forward, and I think that it's the number of those things that are in place and lined up will be the measure of success. So if the community comes along with you, if the local jurisdiction feels that what their financial contribution or financial benefit that they're getting from this makes sense, if we're satisfied with the design and the reinvestment in our facilities, if we have well explained the balance in access to the station between those who are accessibility challenged and bicycles and pedestrians and automobile users, bus bay users, and if we get to the end of that and people say this was a very clearly defined assessment of how to locate facilities, it's basically going to be measured by the number of hands that are in the air that are saying we're content with this approach. That's a non-quantitative approach, but that's, I think it's looking at...
One other point that no one's discussed is that as we do these projects more quickly, it frees staff to do more projects. And so with the same number of people, we can increase our productivity because we're getting something into the ground in a year, year and a half, instead of 4 or 5 years.
Okay. I just want to make one, Mr. Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Brown. I have a question about the job, how the jobs are allocated. Is it when they're metro projects, is it a third, a third, a third about the employees that are supposed to be working these projects, or if it's in a certain jurisdiction, they kind of control the job flow? How does the job part work? What are the requirements?
I'm sorry, when you say talk about the job flow, are you talking about the jurisdiction's responsibilities to provide staff to support this?
No, actual jobs on the construction side, the vendors, that kind of thing.
You're talking about MBE, DBE type requirements?
Not necessarily on the contracting, on the actual employees that will actually be hammering things and sawing. And when I'm talking about jobs, I'm not talking about subcontractors, actual jobs for people.
We're going to be working closely with Prince George's County to make sure that their guidelines are followed. And, in fact, they've made clear that if a developer wants to take advantage of public subsidies that they have available at their disposal, that developer will have to follow the Prince George's County guidelines. Metro has its own guidelines, which our council's office will make sure that we adhere to.
So if there's a project in a particular jurisdiction, then they control, their regulations control the job flow for folks that get hired for these projects.
Well, we
ran into an issue with Prince George's County where there was a disparity between what they wanted and what we were able to offer. And so we came up with this market-based mechanism where, again, if you're not, as a developer, obligated to follow their requirements, but that just means, for example, you'll be not eligible for tax increment financing. And we and the elected officials in Prince George's County felt that that market incentive would cause those developers to follow Prince George's requirements without conflicting with our guidelines.
I guess what I'm really getting at, if Prince George's County is a controlling jurisdiction for this particular project, it could be any project, then is it likely to assume that mostly Prince George's County residents will get those jobs? Just coincidentally, if it's a D.C. project, does that mean only D.C. people get to work in those jobs?
I think that...
We don't have that kind of... That's what I'm trying to...
We can't.
Because we have a problem in the District of Columbia with other public projects, that we have a lot of folks from outside of D.C. that get those jobs, and I want to make sure at least our region is going to make... Because we have a lot of folks coming in from North Carolina and Delaware and West Virginia every day.
Whatever the requirements are of Metro, we can enforce, and whatever the requirements are that Prince George's County has, provided they don't conflict with Metro's, we can enforce. But if they conflict, they can only be voluntary, and we use this market mechanism.
Chris is going to comment on that. Sure. Just in response to the question, I'm not aware of any jurisdiction that has the authority to dictate exactly the composition of the workforce, because it would probably be unconstitutional to impose a restriction on movement across interstate lines. So we have what Mr. Bodekheimer and Mr. Golden have been talking about have to do with preferences that we afford in the minority business enterprise as far as subcontracting. But even in that, we're not talking about who is the identity of the persons who are actually doing the work. So the answer is no. We don't have any requirements establishing
where it is from requiring that in any one project a particular percentage has to come from that county. There's no requirement, and I'm not aware of anything. And I think it would probably be unconstitutional because it would be a restriction on interstate travel. I mean, that's a fundamental constitutional right, is to move from place to place. So I'm not aware of any, but I suspect that it would not pass muster.
Okay, thank you. Let me just go back to the clarifications, because I think that if you look on page 2, and I, one thing I like about this, I think we've gone over the issues of policy. I think we do need to have staff develop a policy presentation on this. I think while I support too creativity, I think we've got to understand a little bit about what we're doing here for the purpose of future projects. But one thing I like about this is that there is an incentive here, if I understand it correctly, to actually get this deal done. And the incentive is that the credit, if you will, is linked specifically to the negotiated land value. And so if you don't reach that point, and I just want to be clear on the second full paragraph on page 2, it reads, assuming a development agreement is reached and that closing occurs on Metro's land, and assuming board approval, the new Carlton RFQ anticipates that an amount not to exceed $650,000 would be deducted from the developer's payment to Metro for the negotiated value of Metro's land. In other words, this is not a situation where we're paying in an ongoing way. You know, the process has to reach a point where we have a negotiated value of the land, and then we make the deduction. So that incentivizes, in my opinion, you know, this deal to be completed. Is this language correct in terms of what we understand
here?
Yes,
absolutely.
So that the risk to Metro does not occur until the deal is effectively done. So I think this, satisfies a lot of my concerns, because this is a risk issue as much as it is anything else. But we are encouraging the developers to understand that there will be an amount specific that they can count on if the deal comes to completion. Am I right in saying all of
this? Yes.
Okay, good. All right. Further discussion on this point? But let's have the development, Mr. Sarles, Mr. Bodekheimer, Mr. Goldman, can we get into the development of some guidelines on this for future consideration?
Yep, absolutely.
For us to see, okay, and approve. Okay. Then this discussion is concluded, and there being no further business, I don't believe, to come before this committee, you see the subsequent joint development and real estate committee agendas. There being no further business to come before the committee, I now adjourn this meeting at 10:30 on September 30th, 2010. Thank you.